to introduce Austin Harkey. Austin is from the Twin Cities, a graduate of Luther Seminary, and he's here this week, which we are thrilled to do a series on reconstructing community with our transgender siblings. We don't have a mic in this room, so he's going to use his outside voice. And when you ask questions or offer comments, if you could do the same, that would be most helpful to Austin. So thank you, Austin.
I'm so glad you're all here. I just passed out some resource lists. If you've got extra down toward the end, pass them back that way, because I don't think we're going to quite have enough. If people want more, we'll get more. I'm so glad you're here today. This is exciting. I was thinking like three people were going to show up. Let's talk a little bit about what we're going to be doing this week. I'm trying to have this sort of three-bit course really build on each other. So if you come today and then come on Wednesday and then you come on Friday, you're going to be so prepared. It's going to be great. If you miss one of those, still show up. You might have some extra questions. That's totally okay, too. Come talk to me afterwards. Talk to the other people in your groups. It's going to be a good time. Essentially, what we're talking about over the next couple of days is how we exist as faith communities today, inclusive of our transgender siblings. That's the big idea. We're going to look at that in a bunch of different chunks. Today's chunk is going to be 101. So if you know nothing about trans folks or trans identities, this is great. You don't need to know anything to be in this room. If you do know, and I know that some folks are coming into this room with their own experiences and their own identities, I love hearing your experiences, so feel free, like during question time, we'll maybe be talking a little bit more about that and where you come from. But we're going to start off introducing ourselves a little bit. Let me tell you a little bit about me, and then I want you to introduce yourselves to each other a little so we can start a little bit more of a conversation. So my name's Austin. My pronouns are he, him, and his. And I am teaching this session because I'm a trans guy, which means that when I was born, I was assigned female at birth. The doctors took one look at me and went, aha, it's a girl. And then 20 some odd years later, I was like, psych, I'm not. I grew up in non-denominational churches when I was younger, very conservative theology in those churches, very strict ideas about what women were and weren't allowed to do, which was kind of a bummer for folks like my mom, who didn't really hold much with that kind of theology, but she really loved the community that she was in. So she raised me and my two younger sisters to be kind of that whole girls can be whatever they want to be type thing. It was definitely not a restrictive environment in our house, but within our faith community, it was a little bit more restrictive. So that was kind of where I grew up. They were also not big on LGBT people in that church. And I grew up knowing that I felt a little bit different, but I couldn't really articulate how that was. So as a teenager, about 15 years old, I fell in love with my best friend, as you do, and came out as bisexual as a teenager. So that was my first coming out. And then I went, oh, God, I'll never have to do that again. Thank goodness that's out of the way. And then when I was in my early 20s, I ended up coming out as transgender as I was in seminary. And so that was a very interesting experience to try and figure out faith and identity all at the same time. And they're very connected, and I can speak more about that later. But that's a little bit about me. Now I'm here today. I know I look like I'm 12, but I'm 31. This is the effect of being a trans guy. You kind of you start puberty later, and so then you look younger for a lot of your life. But I graduated from Luther Seminary in 2014. My degree is in biblical studies, specifically in Hebrew Bible, and so that's kind of my background.
Before you go on, would you explain what the she, her, hers, and...
Absolutely. Right, so pronouns are the way that we use to refer to somebody when they're out of the room. If somebody leaves their bag on a table, you're like, oh my gosh, whose bag is this? Is this his bag? Is this her bag? Is this their bag? Pronouns are how we refer to each other in the third person. So that's what a pronoun is. So my pronouns are he, him, and his, but somebody's pronouns might be she, her, hers, or even they, them, theirs, and then there are a whole bunch of pronouns beyond that even. So I'm starting you out baby steps with the they, them, theirs, but there's many more. So when I say, what are your pronouns, it just means, what words do you use to refer to you? So if you leave your bag on the table, I can say, ah, this is his bag, or this is her bag, or this is their bag. So that's what pronouns are, very basic. We're going to talk a lot more about pronouns as we go on. So if you would just turn to some partners around you and give them your name and your pronouns, and then what made you curious about this session? And I'm going to clap at the end of this so that we can get everybody's attention back, because it's hard. Once we start talking, we can't stop. So when you hear me clapping, we'll come back to the slides. But go ahead and introduce yourself real quick. Assuming something about somebody's gender, there are a lot of places where it's good to ask somebody's pronouns, and to make it less awkward for the person you're asking, if you start with your pronouns, that's a way better way into the conversation than just being like, hey, who are you? So that's why we learned to introduce ourselves with our pronouns. I'm so proud of you all. Let's talk about our group commitments for this series. I'm going to write down some commitment ideas here, and then we're going to try to hold to those, because one of the things that can be difficult about conversations around LGBT identities and inclusion is that we can disagree, and disagreement is good. Disagreement is fine, unless it is rooted in the oppression of somebody's being as a human, right? So disagreement is good. We want to create a situation where we can disagree with each other, we can ask really big questions, but everybody can be protected in the space. So that's the idea here. So I put up some questions here, things that we might ask as we try to think up a group commitment. Are there any sort of rules that you think would be a good idea to surround our conversation with each other? What can we do to help answer these questions?
Only
one in the back there?
Curiosity.
Curiosity is a great way to start things. And we want to be careful with curiosity because we don't want it to be sort of an objectifying curiosity where we're like, wow, you're weird and you're different, I'm curious. It's more of a, like, who are you as a person? I really want to know. That kind of curiosity. Perfect. Other ideas?
Listening closely.
Listening closely. Gonna have to decipher my chicken scratch here. Excuse me.
Using I statements.
I statements, I love it. So for instance, give me an example of an I statement.
I am sitting on the floor.
Easy. Right, and that doesn't mean, and I'm judging you all for sitting on chairs, right? That's just a high statement about yourself. One back there.
Assume good intent. Some of us don't know as much as we want to know, and if we say it wrong, assume that we're here to learn.
Yep. All right, assume good intent. What else over there?
I think to piggyback on the I statement, we want to speak from our own experiences rather than big generalized statements.
Yes. Own experience. And that also goes for, we don't want to say, there can be ways that we can offer stories from our own lives that include other people in a way that's respectful, keeping other people's identity anonymous, for instance, but we wouldn't want to be like, oh yeah, my sister just did this and this is what happens, and like sharing other people's stories can be a little bit more dicey, so we want to be careful about sharing other people's stories versus sharing our own stories. Any other ideas? All right, well, these are all great ways to start, so I really appreciate you jumping in with me on these. So if we get to a point where we're like, oh, having a conversation and maybe somebody is getting a little close to some of these borderlines, we can remind them that these are our group commitments, and this is what we're going to do together. So, let's start here. Who is my trans neighbor? This is something that a lot of us are maybe wondering about. What does it mean when we use the word trans? Who are these people, other than just me standing up here? What does this mean? And what we're going to do is we're going to zoom way out. The way that I like to think about the LGBT community is like objects in space, right? Bajillions of years ago, and even just hundreds of years ago, we didn't have high speed or high intensity telescopes, right? You looked at the sky with your naked eye and you went, okay, we got moons, we got suns, well, one really in our galaxy, and then we've got like shooting stars. There's just a certain number of things you can see, right? And then we get telescopes, and suddenly we're like, oh my gosh, that's like a black hole, and that's a supernova, and we didn't know those things existed until we got telescopes, right? So when we talk about the LGBT community, sometimes people are like, why do we just keep adding stuff on, and like, this is all getting too complicated, and is this new, and is it in the water? Like, people get really freaked out about this. Basically, we're learning more about stuff that has always existed because we're more connected, we're talking to each other, people are feeling safer to share their stories. There are a lot of different reasons why things seem like they're getting more complicated, but rather than more complicated, I would think about this as more diversity. Like, you would be excited if there were 8 million new species of flowers out there, right? Same kind of thing. So, let's talk about this big community, and we're going to zoom out. I know this is small text, so I will try to read as much of it as possible off of the screen here. But what we're going to be talking about in the big picture is the LGBT community, or larger, if you want the full acronym we're using right now, LGBTQIP2A+. So, that sounds like a mouthful, I know. The idea here, though, is that we are always bringing people in. We are always drawing the circle wider to include all of these different kinds of identities. And I'm going to break this down, but here's the big picture. So, who we're talking about in that bigger acronym is lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, I know that one makes people uncomfortable, we'll talk about it, intersex, pansexual, two-spirit, asexual, and more. So, we're going to take a look at those and kind of break this down, because I know that that seems like a lot. The way that we understand more about this big community is by, what else? Putting people in boxes, right? This is what we're going to do here. We're going to take this community and break it into two bits. Bits around orientation and bits around gender. And then we're going to go deeper into the gender side. The orientation side you probably already have some familiarity with. Your orientation, sometimes we call it our sexual orientation or our affectional orientation, because not everybody is into sex, go figure. It gives us a sense of the kind of person that you are attracted to, the kind of person you're emotionally, romantically attracted to, right? So that's your orientation. Orientation is something that's internal to you and nobody else can see it. So you can't assume it about somebody else. We have reasons we think we can assume it, but that's actually more about gender, which gets complicated. We make our orientation visible in the world through all kinds of behavior, like personal behavior, like holding hands with somebody, and also through social traditions like marriage, right? So there are ways that we make our internal orientation visible to the world. We may also have a relational orientation, which means that you might be monogamous, or you might be polyamorous, or you might be celibate. Those are all kinds of ways that you might express that orientation that you have. So this is all orientation. This is all one big box. The other big box has to do with gender. Your gender is made up of what we think of as three sort of factors, right? Your gender is made up of your body, which is, you know, your body. It's your internal and external reproductive organs, your chromosomes, your hormone levels, and your brain matter. That's your body. Your gender identity is your internal self-perception and experience of being female or male, or both, or either one of those things. That's your gender identity. Your gender expression, because identity is internal, kind of like orientation is internal, nobody can see that. So the way that we express it is through our gender expression, and that's your clothing and your hair and your mannerisms and your voice, and all the things that have gendered expectations that you can see, right, in our society. Different societies have different understandings of what gender expression looks like. So those are the three factors that make up gender. You may heard, if you are a little bit more familiar with this community, you may have heard that bit about your body talked about as your assigned sex. Like earlier I said I was assigned female at birth. That's another way that we talk about how our bodies look. So we've got those three sort of bits about gender. We're going to get a little bit more into those. But if you think about those three like parts of a triangle, that makes up your gender. So now, we're going to have a tiny bit of a quiz, but if you don't know the answer, it's okay, because there are going to be people that will shout it out and help. We've got this nice Venn diagram here, and we've got all these identities that I just gave you over there on the side, and we're going to try to decide, is this an orientation, or is this more about gender, or is it maybe both? So, give me a hand here. We've got lesbian and gay as the first two. Which side did they go on?
Orientation.
Classic. All right, you've got bisexual. Where does that go?
Orientation.
Got it. All right, transgender?
Gender.
Got it. Queer?
Both.
Hey, that was a trick question because I hadn't even talked about it. You already know. I love it. We're going to talk more about that in a second. How about intersex?
Gender.
Okay, and how about pansexual?
Orientation.
And two-spirit?
Gender.
The people that said both, you got it. And the last one is asexual.
Orientation.
Got it. See, these ones aren't easy because they're not sexual. So let's talk about these two in the middle here really quick. Let's talk about two-spirit first. Two-spirit is a term coined in the 90s by a group of Native and First Nations folks that got together up in Canada. They were all LGBT people, people of different genders and orientations who got together and said, you know what, all of our traditions have words for this in our own language, but we're all from different tribes, and wouldn't it be cool if we had one thing that we could sort of use as one label for all of us? So Two-Spirit is specifically a Native and First Nations identity or word for identity. So you might see that, it's especially if you're in Canada, I think it's used a lot more than it is in the States, but Two-Spirit, there you go. Queer is a tricky word because for so long it was used as a slur, right? And in some places it still is used as a slur. However, there are parts of the LGBT community that say, gosh, that acronym is so darn long. Wouldn't it be great if we just had one tiny short word to describe all of us, right? And to embrace some of the weird wishy-washiness and everything, right? So queer has been a word that has been a little bit reclaimed by this community to kind of say, hey, this is a great word. We actually kind of like it sometimes, but it's one of those words that is sort of used within the community, and if you're not part of the community, you don't want to use it. So that's what's going on here. If somebody describes themselves, if you meet somebody in a situation like this, and they're talking about gender and orientation, and they say, well, I identify as queer, then okay, then you can use it for them because they have said, this is my word, it's how I identify. But you wouldn't just walk up to somebody on the street this word, right? Because it's got a history of baggage that is very real. So we want to be careful with the word queer.
I've always had queer used more as a political statement.
Yeah. Yeah, so another way that queer has been used is in a more academic way. So like queer theory, for instance, is an academic discipline, right? And it's also used in a lot of political organizing, specifically because it's one of those short words that can have a huge variety of people. And we are seeing that more than we have before, but people still want to be aware of the baggage that may come with that word. And it's really, it's just a huge thing between, like, it's a generation gap word, right? People, it's, you can almost always cut it off at about age 35. Like, 35 to 40 and older are like, no, absolutely not. And then younger, they're like, this is my word, I love it, right? And so you have to have a community that has both of those words in it, so you have to find a way to balance that. And the other word that you might not be familiar with, a couple other words here. So pansexual and bisexual are very similar parts of the community. There was a period of time where bisexual was the word that basically meant I'm attracted by meaning two, right? I'm attracted to two genders, male and female. And so for that, essentially, you thought, like, well, that's everybody, right? And then there was this sort of movement where they said, well, it turns out not everybody is just male or female, and we want to be inclusive of the idea that we're attracted to all people, right? So pansexual, pan being the Greek word for all, right? So that was the idea that you could be attracted to people regardless of gender. Within the last 20 years, there has been a lot more of a coming together between the bisexual and pansexual community to kind of say, really, we mostly agree on everything. We mostly, it's mostly a synonym at this point, but there are some people that really feel strongly about one or the other, one label or the other. And so we're not erasing either of those labels, just recognizing that the community is sort of evolving to understand those words differently over time. Asexual folks are folks that don't have a sexual orientation. They do. It's asexual. They don't have a sexual attraction to people, or they may experience it in a very a smaller way than what we would think of as normal, right? So asexual folks, this is where it can get kind of both complicated and interesting. Asexual folks may be romantically or emotionally attracted to people, but just not sexually. So asexual people, that's why we bring in this idea of affectional orientation rather than sexual orientation, because asexual folks may just not be into sex. That's totally okay. This last one over here, intersex folks, we're going to talk a lot more about them because they're kind of on the gender side. But intersex people are people who are born with differences in sex development. Essentially what that means is that those pieces of your body, your hormone levels or your reproductive organs or your chromosomes, they may be what we would think of as like a mix of what we would typically think of as masculine and feminine. So those are intersex folks. So we're going to talk more about that side of the gender of the Venn diagram. So, who are trans people? What is this big trans umbrella, right, when we talk about transgender folks? I'm going to throw a lot of words at you, and it's okay if they don't all stick. Let's stick what sticks, and we'll move from there. Trans is an umbrella term. It incorporates a bunch of different identities, but they all have to do with having a gender that is different from your assigned sex. So that's the basics of what trans means. Gender that's different from the way that your body was assigned at birth. The word cisgender is used to describe people who aren't trans. So most people are cisgender. These are both Latin prefixes. Trans means across from or moving between. Cis means on the same side. So the idea is your assigned sex and your gender are either on the same side or there's a moving across. That's kind of where those words come from. So that's how we would describe gender. So identities that fit under this big trans umbrella include trans men. That's somebody like me who's assigned female at birth but knows themselves to be male. You have trans women who are assigned male at birth but know themselves to be female, right? So those are sort of your two basic chocolate and vanilla binary options. Then you've got folks who are non-binary, right? Now when I say binary, that means a system of two things, right? Binary means two. So if you are non-binary, you may feel like you are more of a combination of male and female, or you might feel like that system itself doesn't really, like your gender doesn't fit in that system. You are non-binary. So that's another way that you might identify. Other ways, like asexual, you might also be agender, which just means that you don't have a strong sense of your gender. And for folks that are agender, usually they'll just kind of go with, a lot of times they'll, it's like they don't necessarily have a strong disassociation with the sex they were assigned at birth, because they don't necessarily feel like some, it's like harder to figure out, because like, if you didn't know that chocolate exists, you might not want chocolate, right? Like, if you kind of have to understand more about how sex and gender works, I think, for agender folks before you're like, wait a minute, I'm neither of these things. So sometimes it can take a minute to catch. Gender fluid folks are people who may experience their gender as something that changes over time, hence the fluid part. And then genderqueer folks, genderqueer is a really interesting word, kind of like what you were saying with the more political aspect of the word queer. Some genderqueer folks use the word genderqueer to essentially say, I want to embrace the fact that I am not male or female, and that system doesn't really work for me, and it's kind of a big term that doesn't say specifically how you identify, so people can like the messiness of that term. The messiness can be a good thing in that term, right? The other reason somebody might identify or genderqueer is to note that their gender expression or their gender understanding of themselves intentionally disrupts the gender binary. So that's the more like political aspect of it. The idea, so a genderqueer person, for instance, who likes that term because of the political like backing of it, might say, for instance, I identify as genderqueer and I was assigned male at birth, but I love to wear dresses because I think the idea that men can't wear dresses is dumb. So that's like, it's making a point about the gender stereotypes that we have, and that's something that they might feel strongly about, which is why they might choose that identifier. So that's a bunch of different words all under that trans umbrella, right? That's a huge amount of diversity even within the trans community. Intersex identities and trans identities are different. So we gotta understand that. However, the experiences that intersex folks and trans folks have can sometimes be very similar. For instance, if you are an intersex person who is born with differences in sex development, right? Usually, for the past several hundred years of Western medical intervention with intersex infants, you are usually assigned a sex at birth even though you are intersex. Usually they will kind of say, well, does this baby's external genitalia look more male or more female? We're going to make a decision and maybe have do surgery on this kid now so that they fit that box. So the Intersex Society of North America has been working for a long time to stop surgery on intersex babies so that they can grow up and understand themselves without having that surgical intervention right when they're a little kid, before they know anything about themselves. So for an intersex person who maybe was sort of given and assigned a sex at birth, even though they're intersex, they may grow up and decide to transition to live as a different gender. So even though they are intersex and not trans, they might transition. We're going to talk about what transition means in a minute. So that's just to emphasize the idea that intersex and trans are two different things, but we have some similar experiences. So, I know this is a lot going at you at once. We're going to do a lot of questions, it's okay. So let's do some language basics. So when you're talking to trans folks, you don't accidentally put your foot in your mouth. And it's okay if you do in most scenarios, because we're loving and we care about you, but it's always good to know what you do. So transgender is an adjective or a descriptive word. So you wouldn't say, that is a transgender. You would say, that is a transgender person, right? Because it's a descriptor. So that's the idea behind the language here. And you don't also have to add the ED on the end of the word, not transgendered, just transgender. That was something that people noticed for a while within the trans community. We were using transgendered until we were like, wait a second, this doesn't make sense if it's an adjective. You wouldn't say somebody is African-Americaned. That doesn't make sense either. Like, it didn't make sense in terms of the grammar of it. And so we were like, okay, let's get rid of that ED at the end. And then there's been a recent movement. You would think this is a small thing, but it's kind of an interesting thing to watch within the community. We used to write trans man or trans woman as one word, so it was trans man, trans woman. And then we were like, well, wait a minute, because that kind of identifies them as not really being a man or not really being a woman. They're like a thing that's separate all on its own, right? So instead, we made that space there, so it's trans space man. So you're a man, but you're trans man, in the same way that you would be not just a blonde man, you'd be a blonde man, right? You're kind of in that space, and says something about the personhood of the person in question. So, go ahead.
So along that line, is there ever any conversation about kind of using that people first language where you're not necessarily talking about the identity or the sexuality, but you're talking about the person first?
Right, so person first language is something that you might be familiar with, especially within disability context. We talk about person first language a lot. It's actually something that is, it's an individual preference, but it's something that's seen in some communities more than others. For instance, in Black or African American trans communities, there's a tendency not to say, I'm a trans man. They'll say, I am a man of transgender experience, to kind of use that person first language, saying like, well, this is something that, you know, is interesting to note about me, but I'm just a person, right? I'm just a guy. So sometimes that person first language, like woman of transgender experience, man of trans experience, will come up, and it just depends on the community and the individual. So, some things not to use, words that have fallen out of favor. Transsexual is a word that was used for a long time and is used a little bit less now. The reason why is because transsexual was used specifically to say this is a person who has medically transitioned. It was much more about like, have they had the surgery? That kind of thing. That was around transsexual, right? When we realized that that was really inhibitive because some trans folks don't want to transition and don't want surgery, we kind of moved to transgender rather than transsexual, because it's saying more about your identity and less about what you have done. So that's kind of what that movement has been around. We used to call any surgery a transgender person may undergo a sex change, and we don't call it that anymore. There's lots of different ways to refer to it, but the most common one right now is gender confirmation surgery or gender affirmation surgery. The idea is that it's a surgery that some different kinds of surgery that people might choose to have, but it's not a requirement to be trans at all. And we're going to talk more about that. Now when we talk about somebody, for instance, if we talk about somebody who was assigned female at birth and lives it as male, and has, we talk about that as they're transitioning, or they've transitioned, rather than like they've had a sex change, they've transitioned. That's the language that we use now. And then this last one here, hermaphrodite, is a word that we used to use to refer to intersex people. So if you're more familiar with that word and you're like, ah, now I know what you're talking about, that's what it was. Hermaphrodite is a word that came out of a Greek myth that was about a Greek myth of somebody who had both what we would think of as masculine and feminine genitalia. And so when, you know, people in the ancient world, which we'll talk about, first were like, oh my gosh, intersex people are a thing, they connected it to this Greek myth, and that's why that term came about. But intersex is the word that we use today. So that's a lot about language. So when we talk about transition, there's kind of this stereotypical understanding that all trans folks choose to transition, and that's not necessarily true. Transition comes about usually because people are experiencing something called gender dysphoria. Gender dysphoria is the sense of a dissonance or a discord between the gender that people see you as and the gender you know yourself to be. There's like this discord, and sometimes, especially in little kids, they'll explain this by saying, well, I'm in the wrong body. Like, I'm me, but I'm in the wrong body. And that's sort of the narrative that has kind of come up around trans folks. That's not necessarily how all trans people feel. For instance, I really love my body. I think I'm in a great body. I appreciate my body. And lots of trans folks do. But sometimes that's the easiest way to explain I don't feel right in my body is to say, well, I'm me, and then here's the outside, right? And that's the easiest way sometimes to explain it. So to lessen gender dysphoria, you may transition so that you can be seen in the world as who you really are. There are a couple different ways to transition. There is social transition, which is usually things like changing your name, changing your pronouns, changing your gender expression and the way you dress. And there's medical transition, which might include hormone replacement therapy, or it might include different kinds of gender confirmation surgery. So that's your medical transition. And then there's legal transition, which basically means how long is it going to take for the DMV to get on board with changing your driver's license? It takes a long time. So those are different ways that people may transition. And you may choose to just socially transition and not do anything else. You may choose to change your legal documents and not do anything else. You may decide to have certain kinds of gender confirmation surgery, but never go on hormones. Those are all totally legitimate options. It's about what is going on with what you need to do to feel at home in your body. That's really the bottom line of it all. So here's a complicated thing when it comes to transition, and that is, you'd think actually that this question would have an easier answer. Is being trans a mental illness? You would think, well, no, of course it isn't, right? And at this point, like, if you ask that question, is being gay a mental illness? You'd be like, no. Being trans is not a mental illness, but there's a complication because if you want to medically transition, you have to have a psychological diagnosis, or doctors won't allow you to medically transition. And it's specifically because of malpractice lawsuits. If you don't have a psychiatrist or a psychologist letter, a doctor could theoretically be sued for malpractice. So there's this complicated thing going on where, no, being trans is not a mental illness, but we have to have a psychologist essentially say, yes, this person is really trans. And so it kind of muddies the waters of the mental illness thing. I know that makes it complicated, but does that kind of make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does it send it too much down a rabbit hole for me to ask, was there some medical malpractice suit that started that, or?
No, the organization that kind of decides these things is called WPAC, the World something, something, something. Anyway, they're the World Medical Association for trans folks, essentially. And that was started and originally was part of what was called the Harry Benjamin Standards of Care. Harry Benjamin was a psychologist that worked with trans folks in the early part of the 1900s. And they essentially came up with, like, this is the best practice that will be good for trans folks and also good for doctors. And that was kind of what they came up with. So the WPATH standards are now the standards of care for trans folks.
Thank you.
Yeah. So when we talk about trans youth, people are always super nervous because there's been so much, you know, hullabaloo about, like, oh my god, the kids are transitioning and they're all trans, all the kids, oh no. There's a lot of fear around this. And basically, it's very much the it's in the water kind of fear where people are like, why are there so many more trans kids now than there were before? It turns out it's because parents are listening to their kids and are not as afraid to acknowledge that their kid might be trans as they used to. 50 years ago, if you came to your mom or your dad and you said, mom, dad, I know I'm a girl, and you were assigned male at birth, they'd be like, please don't talk about that. We don't want to be kicked out of literally every church in town, right? Nowadays, when a kid comes to their parent and says, mom, I know I'm a girl, they go, oh, I feel like I heard something about that on National Geographic, right? Like, it's something that people are more aware of now, and that's good in a way. Awareness is good in a lot of ways, and in some other ways. We'll talk about that later. So when we talk about kids, and we talk about developmental psychology, when do people figure out that they're trans? Developmental psychologists have seen that people generally figure it out either between ages 2 to 3, because that's the first time you're like, I'm a person, and you have an identity. There's ages 10 to 12, or 10 to 14, which is like puberty age, right, around puberty. And then the last one is weird, because it only really shows up in places where sociologists call this delayed adolescence, essentially like places where people go to college. Because suddenly you're like out on your own and you can kind of live your own life, but you're still sort of treated as a minor, even though you're not anymore. It's a weird sociological thing. But between the ages of 18 and 22 is kind of the third big point. So you may figure out that you're trans at age 3 and not come out until you're 60. That's totally possible. But those are the three points at which people are most likely to figure it out. Kids love to play with gender, and that's awesome. It's great that kids ask questions about, you know, I'm a boy, and why can't I wear a dress? Is that why? Why do we do that, mom? You know, like, I'm a girl, and they won't let me play baseball on the baseball team with the boys. Why not? And, like, they ask questions that get us asking good questions about gender, right? Gender-creative kids are great. Sometimes that's just all it is kids are being gender creative, and that's awesome. But sometimes kids are really trying to tell their parents and their family members that something's going on with their gender. So the way that psychologists have kind of helped figure out, is this kid just being creative and awesome, or is this kid trans and maybe they need some help in understanding that, is by asking if the kid is consistent, insistent, and persistent about their gender. So those are the three questions. So is this a kid who has been talking about this for years? Is this a kid who is insistent every time you call them a boy and they're like, no, I'm a girl, mom, and they're like insistent about it, right? Are they persistent and really in their case about it all the time? Parents know they notice those things. So if the kid is consistent, persistent, and insistent, that's the time when you might go to a family therapist and start talking about it with them as something that might really be the situation that this kid really is trans. So that's kind of the way that we tease that out a little bit. Yeah, but.
So when you say kids love to play with gender, are you talking the 2 to 3 year age, the 10 to 14 year age?
Yeah, usually kids love to play with gender until about age 6 when they start getting beat up if they do the wrong thing.
Okay. So on the definition of where you would kind of reach that, I'm a middle school teacher,
sure.
So 10 to 14 is like my sweet spot.
Yep.
The kid who's consistent and persistent quietly, but then when it's time for conference says, make sure I'm Damien. Mm-hmm. Call me, I'm going to be a he. Mm-hmm. And so you talk to the parents and it's like Damien and he and so that's different than
so when we talk about this consistent, insistent, persistent thing with kids, it's usually like age 8 and lower that we're talking about, because as we get, you know, around that age, like 7, 8 and older, by that point, kids are pretty, they pretty much know what's going to get them in trouble, and they know when to shut up about stuff that's going to get them in trouble. And so that's when it becomes more complicated, because you start sort of shoving that stuff down, right? And you might only have certain situations where you're insistent and persistent. And you can't be consistent anymore, sort of for your own safety and well-being. So it gets more complicated as they get older. And just to confirm here, so that nobody is freaking out about little kids transitioning, there is no form of medical transition for kids under age 10. It just doesn't exist, so don't fret yourself about it. The first thing that could possibly happen if a kid has, usually the kid gets in therapy, no doctor is going to do anything before the kid's been in therapy for a while, so there's that. The first thing that can possibly happen for a kid that is right, like pre-puberty or right puberty age, is you can start on something called hormone blockers. Hormone blockers are these really cool things that essentially suppress your natal puberty so that you don't start going through puberty, but they're completely reversible. And when you go off of them, you just start puberty back up again. So it's essentially pressing the pause button on puberty for kids. And the idea behind that is that it allows the kid and the parents, the whole family, a longer period of time to try to understand what's going on. It's essentially just hitting the pause button. And that's really helpful for families that are like, oh my gosh, my 10-year-old just started talking about this year, and we don't know if this is something to be really concerned about or not. They might choose, after maybe 6 months or so of therapy, they might choose to go on hormone blockers, and at that point, doctors will work with them to try and figure out whether hormone blockers and then what we think of as hormone therapy to help them transition would be good, or if they just need to be on hormone blockers for a while to understand more about themselves, and then you can go off hormone blockers, and you're going to be a little late to puberty, but who isn't once in a while? So that's what you can do first is hormone blockers, and that's the first thing, and it's totally reversible. In most states in the U.S., there is no way to start medically transitioning in terms of hormone therapy, so this is like, for instance, for me, hormone therapy is injectable testosterone. That's what I take. There's no way to get hormone therapy or gender confirmation surgery in most states until you're 18. It just doesn't happen. In some states, there are cases where you can start medically transitioning at age 16, but they require parental consent, and in most cases, it's both parents' consent. So if even one parent is not on board, you can't start. So those are kind of the gateways that we have to make sure that kids stay safe. So here's the big question that people ask, why does this happen? Why are people trans? Why? And the answer is we have no idea, but we have some guesses. It could be genetics. We've done some interesting studies, and you'll notice with all of these studies, they're done on trans men and trans women. We have like no studies on non-binary people or agender people, because people are trying to understand sort of the ends of the spectrum, because they think that's gonna be more, you're gonna be able to see more of a difference, essentially. So all the studies are done on trans men and trans women. We see some difference in genetics in terms of whether or not your body can receive the hormones that you naturally produce. So for trans women, for instance, there have been studies that have shown that their bodies just don't react to testosterone that they naturally make. It just like won't receive it in a lot of cases. And I think that might be a little bit of what's going on. It could be hormone exposure in utero. There's been a lot of studies on what's called testosterone wash that happens when you're in utero and what that does as you're growing. It could be that there's brain structure. We know that there are brain structure differences. We don't know why there are brain structure differences. In terms of the amount of gray matter and white matter in your brains, that's the easiest way to understand it. Turns out trans women have brains that look more like cisgender women than they do like men. And same thing, trans men's brains look more like cisgender men's brains than they look like women, which is what they were assigned at birth. So we notice that there are some differences. And there have been studies done on the brain thing both before hormone therapy and after. And we see the same thing regardless of the hormone therapy. So weird differences. And then we also have some ideas about this being evolutionarily beneficial for humans as we have aged through the years. There's this thing called the kin selection hypothesis that's used to explain why people are LGBT, people have different orientations and genders. The kin selection hypothesis basically says The more adults you have taking care of a kid, the better off that kid does. And any parent that is trying to take care of a little kid knows that, right? The more people you have to babysit, the more people you have to buy Christmas presents, like, the better that kid is gonna, the more resources that kid will have to grow up healthy. Within our ancient human ancestors and Homo sapiens, as we went through the ages, if you were a person with a different sexual orientation or gender identity, you usually didn't have your own biological kids, so you would help take care of the kids of your siblings, and that would help pass on that same genetic code, because those kids were more likely to grow up healthy and strong because they have more adults caring for them. So that's the kin selection hypothesis, just one reason why this might happen. There also may be some environmental factors. We don't know. There could be things about a kid's early understanding of their self, about their experiences through puberty, about your relationship to your body, and understandings of your particular culture's role and requirements of your gender. There may be some nurture aspects of this. We don't totally know yet. When we ask this question, do you become trans, is this nature or nurture? The answer seems to be yes. It seems to be a little bit of both of those things. The thing to keep in mind, though, when we talk about sociological factors, is that we have absolutely no evidence that you can change somebody's gender by trying to get them to change it. Like, even though it may be somewhat sociological in background, we can't change people's brains to match their assigned sex. It doesn't work. It's been debunked a bajillion times in the same way that reparative therapy for gay and lesbian folks has been debunked a billion times. It's the same thing. So the only thing that pretty much every psychological organization in the world, including the American Psychological Association, says is that the only thing for trans folks, if they want to transition, they have to have paths to transition. That's all we've got. We don't have another way to fix their brain. Transition seems to be what we do. And that's good, because then it allows people to be who they are, to be themselves. And I'm a fan of that for one. So let's talk about gender diversity in human history. Almost every society throughout human history has had some understanding of gender diversity. And that may be because they know and understand that intersex people exist, because we've known about intersex people for as long as there have been humans. It's a natural genetic, well, to say natural genetic mutation sounds like an oxymoron, but it's not. Genetic mutations happen all the time, and that's why we have people with red hair, right? Like, that's a weird genetic mutation. So intersex folks are probably the first kinds of people that our ancestors and people throughout human history came across and were like, wait a sec, what's going on here? But there are also understandings that people who were assigned one gender at birth might live in a different way throughout their life. So you've got ancient myths within Sumerian culture, within a whole bunch of different cultures, and Greek culture and Egyptian culture. Those are kind of the big ones that we, as sort of Western-minded folks, have focused on that area of the world. But there are written records from a whole bunch of places all over the world that include creation myths and stories of deities that are gender diverse in some way. Within Western canon, if you know Plato's Symposium, that was probably the most famous background for gender diversity. It's that story of, Plato tells this story about the beginning of the world when God creates a human that's male on one side, a female on the other side, and the gods get angry, and so Zeus throws a lightning bolt and splits them apart, and that's why we have soulmates, because they have to come back together. It's a beautiful story, but, you know, for folks that are not gender normative or or who are LGB or other orientations, you're kind of like, where's that part of that story? Mm-hmm. So Plato's Symposium was sort of the first big thing that people latched onto and were like, ah, okay, we understand something's different here. We do have historical records from folks throughout the past several hundred years as well. So if you ever heard of Eleanor Reichner, was a really interesting case back when the UK had sodomy laws on the books. Eleanor Reichner was this woman. We now kind of understand her as a trans woman, but that's through our modern understanding. She was put up in the British courts because they couldn't decide whether to try her for sodomy or not, for having a relationship with a man, because they couldn't figure out what her gender was. They were like, now is this a woman with a man, in which case it's okay, or is this a man, in which case it's not? What do we do with this? And that was kind of the first legal case where they were like, we don't know what to do with this person. You've also got, now I don't speak French, so please excuse my French. This is Chevalier d'Eon, perhaps? Tell me if you speak French and know it better. Was a French diplomat and a spy who was assigned male at birth, but lived 33 years of her life as female and was a really good spy for France. Then we have this whole, throughout the Civil War and throughout Western expansion, there were all kinds of stories of soldiers and cowboys who were assigned female at birth, and were like, no, I don't think so. I'm going to be cowboy. Wekwa was the first indigenous, gender-diverse person to meet a U.S. president. She met Grover Cleveland in 1886. She's from the Zuni people of New Mexico, and that was a big deal because it was the, well, I just said it. It was the first gender-diverse indigenous person to meet a president. It was a big deal at the time. So within Native contexts and within other places in the world, there have been stories of gender-diverse people for basically since the beginning. We've got this really terrible story from 1513. Balboa, you know anything about Balboa? He was a conquistador, a Spanish conquistador. And he landed in Panama and met a bunch of people there who, as far as he could tell, were assigned male at birth but were acting like women. And he killed them, killed 40 people with dogs before acting like sodomites because he had no other way of understanding what they were. And the church at that time was very clear about what you should do with sodomites. So that's one case of this idea of a Western understanding and a Western Christian understanding of what you should do with gender diversity not turning out well for folks. So there's a bit of a history there. I'm a little mad about it, if you can tell. So within Christian history, what are we seeing? Within Christian history, we see several really interesting saints in the early days of the sort of Catholic Church's understanding of saints. You had Marius the Monk, Saint Wilgefortis, and Joan of Arc are these three major ones that we talk about. Marius the Monk was is a sweet story. This is, now we're talking 5th century here, so this is a long time ago and stories have a way of mutating over time. But with Marius the Monk, the story was that Marius was a teenager who dressed as male and then joined a monastery. Marius was later accused of getting one of the town girls pregnant, and rather than coming out and saying, well, I don't really think I could have possibly done that, Marius was like, well, okay, was kicked out of the monastery and cared for that kid throughout the rest of that kid's life, and was later sainted. So there's Marius. There's St. Wilgefortis, a much sadder story. St. Wilgefortis was going to be forced to marry a prince against her will, and so she prayed to God, God, please make me ugly so that I don't have to marry this prince. She grew a beard the next day. So, unfortunately, though, her dad was mad about that and did crucify her, which is why she's a saint. So, there's St. Wilgefortis. Joan of Arc, of course, is probably one of the most famous historical, like Western historical stories of gender bending. Joan of Arc was, she fought for the French against the English during the Hundred Years' War, and she was taken captive by the English and put up on trial. And the first thing, that squirrel's as mad about it as I am. The first thing they tried her for was sedition, essentially, even though she was French, it was kind of complicated. The second thing they tried her for was heresy, based on Deuteronomy 22:5, which we're going to talk about on Wednesday, that says women aren't allowed to wear men's clothes. So they charged her with that, and she was found guilty of doing it. It's a really sad story. If you know anything about Joan of Arc, they essentially said, you're doing this thing you're not supposed to do, and she said, okay. And then they took away all of her clothes except men's clothes and were like, why are you still doing it? And then burned her at the stake. So like, it was a really sad story, and you should read more about Joan of Arc if you don't know it. It's got a really interesting story. So, those are three examples within Christian history. The thing that's interesting, especially about that Joan of Arc story, is that throughout Christian history, the understanding of like gender expression and how you should sort of do gender in the world was really influenced by Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas wrote the Summa Theologica, and he has this particular excerpt here where he says, outward apparel should be consistent with the estate of the person, meaning their assigned sex, according to the general custom. Hence, it is in itself sinful for a woman to wear man's clothes or vice versa, especially since this may be a cause of sensuous pleasure. Gross. It's expressly forbidden in the law, Deuteronomy 22, because the Gentiles used to practice this change of attire for the purposes of idolatrous superstition. Nevertheless, this may be done sometimes without sin on account of some necessity, either in order to hide oneself from enemies or through lack of other clothes or for some similar motive. So the big thing that was whack about Joan of Arc's trial is that they were like, oh no, we would usually use this rule about having it out if you had no other clothes, but not in the case of Joan because she's French, she doesn't count. So it sucked. She should have been acquitted and wasn't. So that was kind of the general understanding. The general understanding at the time was not that you had a different identity, gender or orientation-wise. It was, what are you doing? And what clothes are you wearing? Who are you sleeping with? It was the what are you doing that people were concerned with. So that was the case for most of Christian history. So here's my last slide, and then we're going to get talking about some stuff. Within Christian understandings today, a guy named Mark Yarhouse wrote a book a couple of years ago, and he suggested three lenses for how we understand trans folks and gender diversity today. He suggested that there are some people that see this through what he calls the integrity lens, which essentially says that God created people male and female in Genesis 1, and so therefore that is the only, like, that's all we got, Genesis 1, man, woman, and that those people are given very specific roles. If you're a man, you do this. If you're a woman, you do this. Gender complementarity is sort of the understanding here. And so they see trans folks, or people who have different genders, as basically people that are intentionally sinning, intentionally going against what God wants. So that's sort of lens number one. Lens number two, Yarhouse calls the disability lens, which is essentially the idea that, yes, we still think that what the first lens says about Genesis is true, that we're created male and female, bam, only that, and also you have a specific role. However, we recognize that when people fell, when the fall happened, that means that sometimes things happen in the world that shouldn't happen. And so he says essentially that trans folks are not morally wrong for being trans, but they're basically just sick. That's why we call it the disability lens. Basically, he says something is wrong with them, and we need to find a way to make them better. So that's lens number two. Lens number three he calls the diversity lens, and this is the lens, surprise, that most trans folks are seeing things through. This is the lens that believes that gender diversity is part of the natural plan, God's plan for humans. And we read Genesis 1 and 2 very differently. We're going to talk about that on Wednesday. So the idea with the diversity lens is that there is no negative moral thing about being trans. It's a natural part of diversity and even possibly a positive part within Christian communities. So these are kind of the three ways that people are understanding identity today and are trying to understand trans folks and what we should do about trans folks. You usually kind of pull to one of those lenses. Yarhouse himself, I disagree with him about a lot of stuff, but to his credit, he believes that we should have a sort of integrated understanding with aspects of each of these lenses. So that's what we're going to do a little bit of group work around now. But before we go ahead and do some group work, I want to open up some space for questions. So now that I threw all that at you, what questions do you have? If you have been holding anything, and if we don't have any questions now, we're going to go into groups.
I'm sure that I want to make sure that I'm saying this correctly. So when you're transitioning, all the process that goes through that is how, what kind of studies have been done that it proves that it's safe, that you're not going to have like troubles down the road?
Sure. Yeah, so that's been something that obviously, like, parents, for instance, are really concerned about.
Right.
Like, if my kid transitions, what are the moral, medical possibilities? Mm. So the first long-term study with hormone replacement therapy was done about 3 years ago, and it showed a lot better results than we thought they were going to. For a long time, there was this idea that Within 10 years of starting hormone therapy, you might have to have other kinds of medical, like things might, for instance, with testosterone, right? They thought testosterone is hard on your liver. We know that even in cis guys that have testosterone that's too high, it's hard on your liver. So maybe you'll have to then give you medication for your liver. And there was some worries about like there would be problems down the road. It turns out there are not nearly as many problems as they thought there would be. So are there a couple of studies that say that you, for instance, with trans guys, you are at an increased risk of like liver problems and heart problems, but in the exact same amount as you would if you were a cis guy. It's like not more elevated than if you were assigned male at birth. Same thing for trans women and for people that are taking estrogen and progesterone, which is what you would take if you're a trans woman and you're transitioning. Essentially, the risks end up being about the same as if you were a cis person, and we thought that they would be worse. So that's been good news within the past 3 years or so.
That's great.
In terms of studies being done around gender confirmation surgery, there were some early studies that were done about 15 years ago, gosh, what year is it, 2019, like 20 years ago, that originally said that essentially, the findings were that a large part of the people who decided to have gender confirmation surgery later on regretted it. And so that was held up for a long time as like, look, this is a bad thing to do. Trans people don't actually want this. They think they do when they don't. Turns out, in every study done since then, they haven't been able to reproduce that conclusion. Since then, there have been a bunch of studies that have said that through transitioning, trans folks have better mental health outcomes than the people that are sort of the controls who are trans but don't transition. So basically, all the studies we've got right now are pretty positive, and in a lot of cases more positive than we had expected, which is awesome. That's not to say there are no risks transitioening, because there's risks for any kind of medical anything, but they're a lot better than we thought, which is cool.
I had a question, it's kind of weird, but so the first time that I ever heard the words that you were mentioning tonight was 2005, which I guess is pretty late. I was in my graduate school in Berkeley, and I took this class, Feminism, Queer Theory, and the Bible. But I'm wondering, like, when did scholarship from that place begin, you know? Like, was it in the 70s, or like, I understand that, you know, from time, you know, immemorial, but like, when did that discipline, when did people begin to pioneer into that discipline?
Sure. I mean, it was definitely much, much earlier with orientation, right? Like, we've had gay and lesbian and bisexual and pansexual and asexual scholars since, I'm trying to think of, like, the first instance that I can think of, probably the late 1700s, early 1800s, there have been records in terms of orientation. When it comes to gender diversity, within an academic sense, that's something that has really only been something that, like, a discipline done by gender diverse people themselves, probably since the 70s. Like, it hasn't been that long. And that's partially due to it just being something that people actually can talk about in a way that they couldn't talk about before. So part of it is just the times they are changing. Yeah.
I'm curious whether the ambiguity at birth is much, much more prevalent than we've known.
Yeah.
And what, if we just would learn about that, would that be much less of a traumatic thing?
Yeah, for sure. So the estimated number right now for intersex infants is 1.7% of infants are intersex. And you think, 1.7, that's not very much. That's actually the same amount that we think of people born with red hair. It's like the same thing where you've got like a double recessive gene that doesn't show up very often. But if you think about walking down the street in New York and how many people you'd see with red hair, that's like the same number of people that are intersex. The thing about intersex folks is if they don't have external genitalia that looks different at birth, they may not know they're intersex until later on in life. A lot of times you don't figure it out till you're till you start going through puberty and things don't go as people expect. And for a lot of folks, there are chromosomal genetic differences that don't turn on. Like, you know how you hear about like genes that are like junk genes or don't totally turn on? It's way more common than we think to have like XXY chromosomes or YYX chromosomes, but things don't turn on the way that you might expect. So it's actually a lot more prevalent than we would think.
So I just wonder, medically,
What kind of insurance is available, or how, you know, I would think that could be a big issue with families.
It is a big issue. So the Affordable Care Act, did somebody just whisper Affordable Care Act? I feel like I should somebody whisper it. The Affordable Care Act just happened, you know, more recently, which essentially made transitioning something that can't be explicitly not provided by a provider, but it's complicated because, like, let me give you my own case, right? I really wanted to have what's called top surgery, which is essentially a reconstruction of your chest, right? And that was something that was really important for me and my transition. When I tried to go through my insurance to try to see if that was possible, they said, oh, sure, we will for sure cover that if you can find somebody in network who does it. Mm-hmm. Turns out there is nobody in network who does it, right? So the problem sometimes is that even if they can't specifically say, no, you can't have this, it's still really difficult because of the number of people, for instance, the number of doctors and surgeons that are proficient with gender confirmation surgery. In terms of whether it's covered or not, different things are covered in different ways. There are certain surgeries that are covered and certain surgeries that aren't. The only specification within the Affordable Care Act was that you couldn't, it basically gave us the lowest bar possible, and anything above that bar is out of pocket for 80% of people. So yeah, for me, I had a crowdfunding campaign and had a lot of really awesome people make that happen for me. And that's the way that it happens for most people. Yeah.
I'd add that the whole issue of diagnosing gender dysphoria then gives you a medical problem to solve,
yeah,
which is what insurance wants. They don't like to cover things that are elective. They only want to cover things that are medically necessary. And so the diagnosis from a psychologist then creates the opportunity for medical necessity.
Exactly, yeah. And that's another, like, that's just the malpractice thing. That's the other thing, is insurance doesn't cover stuff unless you've got a diagnosis. So you have to have a diagnosis. And then you're saddled with the diagnosis.
So related to that, I forget the psychology manual of
DSM, yeah.
So is that classified in that manual as a mental illness?
Right. So in the DSM-4, which was the previous version, the DSM-4 had something called gender identity disorder. And that was what you were given if you were trans. You were labeled with gender identity disorder. Turns out, as they were doing the revision for the DSM-5, they were like, wow, we sure are classifying a whole group of people as being inherently messed up. So they changed it. So now what's in the DSM-5 is gender dysphoria. So what they tried to do is say, here is a symptom that we're trying to treat, but it's not that you are broken, it's that you have this symptom that we would like to treat. So that's kind of the difference between the last version and the current version.
Are you going to talk at all as you go forward about trans people and orientation? I've known trans people that are oriented, same-sex orientation,
Yeah, so I'm not going to talk too much about that going forward because I'm going to stay really focused on the gender part, but when it comes to orientation and gender, the sort of two circles that I gave you, it's really a mix-and-match ice cream bar. Like, you can be trans and bisexual, you can be asexual and intersex, you can be, like, literally any of those things. And that's why it's kind of hard for people to understand when I try to make that distinction and be like, these two things are different. They are different, but you have, they're two lines that intersect in different ways, but they're still two separate lines. So yeah, so for me, I'm a trans guy and I'm bisexual, but you could just as easily, and there's, when it comes to, like statistics of like, are trans people more likely to be gay or lesbian or bisexual? There is some information that says that trans folks are more likely to have a different orientation other than straight, but we think that's probably because since you're already within the LGBT community, you're more okay with having that other orientation. Versus, it's like once you come out once, you're kind of like, well, this is a hassle to do a second time, but I guess, you know? It's like getting over that first hump is the main problem. So yeah, there are more trans people that tend to be LGB than straight, but it's really a wide variety. Yeah.
And probably why I asked that is I think it's been part of the confusion for people. For people trying to understand,
right,
like that there are assumptions that get made
And for us being all, like, we try to be this big community, right, and that doesn't make it easier for people because they're like, wait, which one are you again? for a lot of times when I go talk with folks about this, I have to be very explicit that trans is not gay 2.0. You don't get gayer and gayer and gayer, that's trans. That's not how it works. So yeah, it's kind of a hard thing to get.
Well, I think too, sometimes about the complicated nature of that for a lot of people who are cisgendered and who are straight, because there is this kind of heteronormative narrative that we all tell one another. Yeah. And it's easy for us to ignore our intersectional identities. Yeah. But it's very easy to start identifying other people's intersectional identities. Oh, so you're gay and you're trans? Like, tell me about that. It's like, well, I'm Lutheran and a dad and cisgendered and right. Straight, right? Like I carry all these things as well, but if you're living in heteronormative society, then it's easy to just say, well, I'm just like everybody else.
Right. Yeah.
You're different, and now let's describe all those ways in which you're different, right? So having that conversation too, I think, can be helpful.
Definitely.
Just because we all have intersectional identities, so let's talk about that
yes.
as well.
And we're going to be doing a lot of that. So let me give you a preview of what's to come. On Wednesday, it's all Bible all the time, and it's going to be awesome. We're going to talk about all of the sort of clobber texts that are used against trans folks, but we're going to move beyond that and talk about how do we actually understand the Bible as a liberating thing for trans folks. That's going to be really fun. Then on Friday, we're going to do a little bit more of that, where we're going to say, how do we, as Christian communities and other faith communities, how do we look at the water we're swimming in and notice it, and how do we have communities that can actually be healthy, hopeful places for gender diverse folks? So that's what we're going to be doing coming up.
Can you tell a little bit about how things went in seminary and stuff like that with the church?
For sure. Yeah. Long story short, I came into seminary thinking that I was going to do youth ministry, and then realized all I wanted to do was sit and read dusty old texts. So I left that program and became a biblical scholar. As somebody who was already out as bisexual, I knew what I wanted to do was study the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible, because that was what people always used against me, right? That was all of those clobber passages against LGBT people. They always cite Deuteronomy and Leviticus and yada yada. And I was really interested in what more was there. And so I spent my years in seminary doing a lot of text study on some of the stuff we're going to be talking about on Wednesday. And as I was going through that process, not only of studying, but also being in community with people, in a context where when you're talking about, it's like if you're at Holden Village all the time and you're talking about spirituality in your faith life all the time, right? You start to recognize that you can't be fully involved in that community unless you are kind of letting some of your guard down, right? Unless you're really letting down some of the walls that you've built up around yourself. And the longer I was in that community and doing that work, the more I was like, there's this sort of last wall, this sort of last box that I haven't wanted to open. And if I don't open it, I'm going to be sort of hiding from people forever. I'm not going to be able to be fully myself in a community. To be loved is to be fully seen. And if I can't let myself be seen, I can't be loved. And that was the point at which I was like, maybe I should think about this gender thing. So for me, I spent my last year in seminary helping with our seminary LGBT group. Luther is an interesting case because it's the largest ELCA seminary in the U.S., but it's also the only ELCA seminary that is not officially reconciling in Christ, meaning they're not officially LGBT welcoming. And there's a lot of reasons behind that. We're doing a lot of work around that. But because of that, I didn't know what the situation would be like if I came out as trans while I was there. I was out as bi while I was there, but they didn't have any out trans people there. And I was like, okay, do I want to try and risk this and be the first out trans person to graduate? I decided not to, after a lot of thought. And so I graduated and then was like, bye, thanks, surprise. And left. So, I don't have pictures here, but there's a great picture of me in essentially a suit and tie on my graduation day. I don't think anybody was surprised. But it was the kind of thing where I didn't want to risk losing my degree and all that time and all that money because some people might have a problem, and there were faculty on staff that did have a problem, and so that was something that I kind of had to weigh. Since coming out as trans, Luther Seminary has had two trans graduates, and they're both in ministry now, and It's great. But yeah, it's been a hard, that was 2014 when I graduated. So within the last couple of years, there's been a lot of conversation about that around trans seminarians and how to support them.
Lawrence.
I don't know how to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway because I'm thinking out loud. But but I'm a gay man, and I have many friends who are all of those, maybe one or two, not but I have friends that are drag queens. I have, you know, those. But when we sit around talking, like two of my, I have a very close friend who's Native and trans woman, and when we're all sitting there talking, a group of friends, and one is trans, and one is gay, and one is drag queen, does drag, and this and that, we don't sit around and talk about labels. And I'm just wondering, and this is probably a naive question, but are these labels so that, are these labels so that straight people can understand us? Or, I mean, why, it's just too bad. You know, when you're talking about someone, it's so easy for white people to say, this man I talked to, this black man I talked to, or they say Asian man. I mean, why do we have to use that? It's just a man, or it's just a woman, or it's just a trans. I mean, why are all these labels, it seems like they're created specifically for people who are uncomfortable and or don't know. So I'm just really thinking out loud because I've never, even as a gay man, I've never really sat and thought, why do we have all these labels?
I think one possibility is that it's for sort of outward facing education. Another huge benefit is so that we can find each other. That's really like for the building up of internal community, I think, is a big thing. And that's really hard when you have a group as diverse as this one is. Because, you know, there's, for instance, there are intra community issues, for instance, like trans men and trans women being not as open and inviting with non-binary folks. Like, that's an intra-community issue. And when we think about those labels, we're like, ah, these labels suck, but they do tell us something about the differences between us that we have to understand. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it is an external-facing thing, and sometimes it's an internal thing. I think the real strength of labels is helping us to find the other people like us, to realize that we're not alone. Mm-hmm. But there are also a lot of downsides, too. Yeah. Okay, we're going to move on to this last bit here. We got about 15 minutes left, and then I'll let you get out of this hot room. I'm going to pass out one more handout here. And what we're doing is we're looking at these three lenses, these three ways of understanding trans identities. And I've got just a little excerpt from each of those people who are sort of big proponents of each one of those lenses. And I want you to ask these questions. And you can just pair up with a neighbor. There's more reading here maybe than you want to do, so pick out a couple of things. But what is a positive aspect of the lens that you're looking at, and what is a negative aspect? And maybe, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to split the room up just into thirds so that we can kind of do this in a better way. So if you're kind of here, we're going to have you look at lens number three, actually. We're going to go backwards. So you're lens number three, the last one on the paper. Lens number two, we're going to have you kind of right down the middle here. You're lens number two. And then lens number one, you're going to be over here. So the lens number one is the integrity lens. Lens number two, the disability lens. Lens number three, the diversity lens. So take a look at this paper and then ask yourselves and each other, what's a positive aspect of this lens and what's a negative aspect? And then we're going to shout out some answers about that. So ignore those second questions there, just the first ones. Let's get some. I'm going to put these up front and then pass them back.
Sure.
Different times.
That's way too far.
I think they're
So that's for one of the six. Thank you.
positive or negative aspect of this lens. I should have put like a content warning for all the women reading that one. I'm sorry. Yeah. Anything positive or negative?
We worked hard to find a positive, so maybe if you're a person that likes clear answers and things, you don't have to think too hard about things. Like my mom.
If you want a distinct identity with very distinct boundaries that you don't have to feel threatened by, it could be helpful.
But you didn't say what might one positive aspect be. You said what is.
Sure. All right.
I couldn't think of one.
How about very simply, yay, God made us human.
Yes, God made us human. Awesome. I love that.
Okay. Just don't be simple.
Good. Any other positive aspects of this first lens?
I have to look at a little bit of the intent. I think it's people who are trying to be faithful to Scripture.
Yes.
I don't think they've looked at in entirety or in different ways because they've been told one thing about what they're reading. But I have to at least honor that they're at least trying to be faithful to God, to Christ, to understand.
Absolutely. I'm glad you said that. If you didn't hear in the back, I don't want to see your pronouns. What are your pronouns?
He said, perfect.
He said that assuming that the author really does believe what they're saying, and that they believe that this is what God is actually calling people to do, and assuming honesty and intent. And I like that. I think that's probably true. Any negative bits around this lens? Anything negative you want to call out?
There's no room for the exception. What do you mean?
No room for the exception or the in-between.
What about single people?
What about single people? Good question.
Yeah, both to be the whole.
Yep. Yeah, when you have a system that requires each person to be a half of something, that does make it really hard for people to be, even if you are called to celibacy, how do you do that and be a whole person? Yeah. Any other negative aspects of this one?
Sucks to be a woman.
Sucks to be a woman. How about the disability lens here? What positive aspects did you see on this lens?
It doesn't try to erase people's transness or their like gender dysphoria.
Yep, good.
It puts it, or it leads this feeling into a system that we know how to deal with. Like, we know how to treat. I mean, we don't know how to treat all mental illnesses, but we know that how to find a system to start tackling these problems is not something that's completely new. It's like, okay, now that we know that this is kind of like a disorder, we can treat it like that and go forward.
Yep, yeah, it puts it within a system of, it takes an unknown and tries to make it known through a system we already have. Yeah. Other positive aspects? You can do the negative.
It kind of takes out the blame. It's like, how unfortunate for you that you have this disease. But it's like not like your fault.
Yeah, right. It takes out that sort of morally culpable thing that requires you to be on your knees about it all the time. Yeah.
And if you, as the person, are experiencing discomfort about your gender identity, then it gives you a way to sort of mitigate. I mean, you know, it sort of approaches it at a different stage. So, assuming that you're experiencing that discomfort about it.
Definitely. Yeah. This is my personal opinion. I think the real strength of the disability lens is for folks that are experiencing dysphoria and going, why is this happening to me? It provides that sort of like, well, lots of bad things happen in the world and this is not your fault. Like, it provides that, right? And it provides a sense of, a bit of really honoring the suffering that may exist. And I appreciate that about that lens. Any other positive or negative things about that one?
Negative, it says who you are is a disability.
Right.
And I mean, it's just that simple that, you know, you suffer from a mental illness, it's a disability. You are in the wrong body, it's a disability. If you're not like everybody else, it's a disability. And it's just not right.
It's
just that simple.
It can be a little better off. Quickly over here to the diversity lens. What positive or negative?
that, like, in, like, in the Bible, it says, like, there was, like, night and day was created, but it didn't talk about, like, dusk and dawn and, like, how there was, like, both in between and not just, like, what it states and how it can be the same thing with gender. Like, there's, like, male and female, but there's also can be in between male and female.
Yeah, so it makes room for the outliers or the difference. Yeah.
It allows for the continuing, creation is an active, ongoing process. That's, you know, the universe is being unveiled even as we continue to study it and to ponder it.
Yeah, the continuing work of creation.
To continue on what Kaisa was saying, we're really comfortable talking about God as Alpha and Omega, mm-hmm. which means God is at the beginning, at the end, and everything in between,
right?
And at the end of this piece, it talks about, instead of asking the text to define and label all that is, we ask God to speak into the space between the words. And I think that's a whole Christian's a good conscience, right? Like, we can ask God to help us understand. Here's the words you've given us, but somewhere in between there's some understanding that we need to have.
Right. If you are familiar with the UCC church, their whole motto is God is still speaking, right? Don't put a period where God has placed a comma. I know that I did write that last one, but are there negative? Negative possibilities here?
For those who see the Bible as a inerrant and literal documentation of the history of God's action, it makes it challenging to accept that.
Right. If you do have a period there and you are a literalist, you say that's a period. Yeah. So that's why we're not going to go through these other questions here, but there's lots of middle ground between 1 and 2 and 2 and 3, but it's really hard to get 1 and 3 to talk to each other, right? Mm-hmm. And that's part of what we're going to be talking about on Friday when we talk about how do we stay in community with each other when we have all of these different ideas about what's going on. Quick last tip.
What I saw as a negative is that there are some things that are binary.
Yeah.
Lights are on or they're off. A food is either kosher or it's not kosher.
We're going to talk about that. I'm so excited because you brought up the kosher thing. Yeah, so we're going to talk more about that on Wednesday. So the last thing I'll say before I let you go is, please don't get me in trouble by putting the sheet that I just gave you on the internet, because it's got a piece of a book that isn't published yet. So please don't put it on the internet. Keep it for your own use. But other than that, you're good to go. So thank you so much for being here.